Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, the loss of a child, the grief spelled out in aching detail. That is the book Griefland. We talked to co-author Armin Bacon about grief and renewal. Also, Peter Nazaredian, a licensed marriage and family counselor, as well as a board-certified counselor, will also join us for part of this conversation. Also today on our program, a way back from homelessness. What are the first steps? And a public market for downtown Fresno. Is it more than a dream? But first, it is something all parents worry about, fear, the loss of a child. It is that very tragedy that brought two Fresno women together, their journey through Griefland spelled out in a book. Here to talk to us about it and grief and renewal is the co-author of the book, Armin Bacon. Many of you also know Armin from her columns in the Fresno Bee. She is also Administrator of Communications and Public Relations for the Fresno County Office of Education. Also joining us is Peter Nazaredian, as I mentioned, a licensed marriage and family therapist plus National Board Certified Counselor. Thank you both for joining us this morning. We're all ready to begin a new year, talking about hope and renewal. In this book, Armin, you chronicle the feelings you experienced with the death of your son, Alex. Were you grieving before that day in July? Because in a way, what you read in the book, you had to kind of slowly watch him and fade away. Tell us about that.
You know, my husband and I, our family started noticing subtle changes in Alex in middle school, and in high school he started really spiraling. And, you know, the reality is grief rears its ugly head in so many ways. And we started grieving the loss of some of our hopes and dreams because there was a transformation taking place before our eyes, something that we knew, I think, deep inside had the potential of not having a happy ending. And so, indeed, we began that grief process a few years before we actually lost Alex. I mean, it felt a lot like we were watching our child drown and our feet were planted in cement at the side of the swimming pool and we just couldn't reach him. And so, yes, there was a grief process that started a few years before we actually lost him.
And, you know, many parents here in the Valley are also dealing with this, struggling with their child who may be struggling with substance abuse or mental illness. Did you meet other parents along the way when you all were trying to reach out to him?
You know, we're meeting them now. I think when a parent is struggling, you're putting 150% of your time and energy and love into your child. So it's hard to go to support groups during that time. I mean, I think we were using all of our energy to harness whatever resources we could for our child. Now, having written the book, families are coming out of the woodwork to share their stories, and we're just learning just how huge this issue is in our valley.
Mr. Nazaredian, it's what Armin talking about. Is that somewhat common in families who are dealing with a child who might be suffering from, as we mentioned, substance abuse or illness? Is it hard for them to reach out because they're just trying to deal with their own situation and their own child, and many of them really not knowing what to do?
Absolutely. Very difficult for parents who are dealing with their kids, and oftentimes they're especially in the teenage years, going through what we call the age of differentiation, where they're actually pushing the parents away to find out who they are. And so you've got this natural process, which is actually a healthy one to understand how they become their own person. But if it's complicated by other issues like drugs, for example, then there's a huge gap, and that parents sometimes play that parent card too much, trying to close that gap. And that's a difficult situation. Parents really need to look in terms of being a consultant in the mid-teenage years to help the child learn. But if it's complicated by other issues, including drugs, alcohol, bad friends, whatever, it becomes impossible because they really are on the outside and deliberately. And
it is a tough time. As a parent, I tell you, it's just a tough journey either way you look at it. Now for you, Armin, and hope you don't mind me calling you Armin. Many of my know Armin and I have known each other for quite some time. Now, it was 4 years in between the death of your child and Nancy Miller's,
yes.
The woman that you would soon befriend and share stories and write this book called Griefland. Before you met Nancy, how were you dealing with the grief? Because your description of grief was just as raw when you met Nancy 4 years
yes.
ago, 4 years in between that time. Was it that you had just not really fully grieved? Had you not given yourself time?
You know, my son died, and a few short months later, my husband's mother died. My mother got seriously ill, and, you know, the tugs of life, people want you back. And I had to get back into the real world in order to take care of others around me. I had grandchildren to take care of. I had an aging mom who was ill. We buried my mother-in-law, and I went back to work. And so when I met Nancy, it really became an opportunity to go back to square one of my grief, lay at the foot of my son's bed, curl up in a little ball, and start the grief process right then and there. I think I had buried it meticulously. I mean, people want you back to normal, and you have to go back to work, and it's hard to show the profound sadness when you're in your work environment. You need to perform and get back into the throes of life.
Mr. Nazaretian, what can happen if you put off that grief process, if you put off grieving and try to move on? Because so many people, as Armin said, you look around, life is calling you, you think you've done it, and you move on too quickly.
You're absolutely right. The interesting thing about the grief process is that it stops. I had a client once who said, I can't handle the loss of a wife at that time, and I'm just going to get drunk for 6 months and kind of get through that process, and then I'll sober up and it'll be over. The brain has an interesting way of shutting down. When you add drugs or alcohol or sometimes go back to work or try to stuff it into a corner, the grief process is, okay, I'll wait. And it just sits there. And 6 months later when he sobered up, it started all over again. So the brain simply needs its time to do it. In Armin's case, I think 4 years went by before you really, you know, said, okay, I'm going to open that door and really start the process. It just waits.
Yeah.
Tell us how you met Nancy Miller.
Well, very interesting. Like we mentioned, it had been 4 years, and it was right after the holidays, early January, and I got a phone call from a dear colleague of mine, excuse me, at Fresno State, saying that one of the lecturers in the English department had lost her daughter on Christmas Day, and would I meet with her? The faculty didn't know what to do with her. They didn't know how to reach out to her, and could I perhaps make contact? And the answer was, of course I would. And we began emailing that night and met at Uncle Harry's for coffee a few days later. And in that moment, I mean, first of all, the chemistry between us was magical. So we had an instant bond. And we asked ourselves that day, is it possible to shake hands with grief? Could we walk through that fire? And by walking through that fire, we had this hunch it would either melt us or reinvent us. And actually, it did both. We wrote nonstop every single day for one entire year, creating 1,500 pages of emails. We met mostly in the middle of the night when our husbands and families were asleep. And we both had full-time jobs, so we did it after hours. And we went to the trenches. We went to the darkest places. And every single day we wrote, I think our kids died all over again. But at the end of that process, we actually felt that we were more human. And I mean, that was our hope, that, you know, was it possible to emerge from this a better steward of mankind, a person with more compassion, maybe a little bit more human. And the process, I think, revived us both.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you say every night, what was that like for you to have someone to share these feelings with, because as you even mentioned, your co-author, her friends and her coworkers didn't know what to do. And we see that a lot with the people who are around you. They don't know what to do.
No, and you know, Juanita, our culture, we don't have a language for loss. You know, we send sympathy cards. We say, I'm so sorry for your loss, if there's anything I can do. But then everybody wants you to be okay. So, I mean, it sort of drops off from there. Well, Nancy and I went to the ugly places. And we wanted to say our children's names out loud. That's something other people, I mean, that's the advice I give to everybody. Don't be afraid to share stories and memories and say the lost child's name out loud. As a mom, I want to hear stories about Alex. I want to remember what he did in preschool that was so endearing to another mother. And so we said our kids' names out loud. We talked about the ugly emotions, about all the things that were going on inside of us, the side effects that we were embarrassed to share with others. I mean, my handwriting changed. I felt like there were days when I got up to go to work when I felt like I had put on so much makeup I looked like Baby Jane, and we were able to go to those unsavory places and we could cry and scream and be sad together. And the big lesson we both learned was, you don't have to go through it by yourself. You can hold someone's hand. And what started out as a relationship born out of loss, we became the very best of friends. And I think there's probably nobody on the planet now that knows me as well as Nancy does.
I bet that's important. How important is that when you go through the grieving process, Mr. Nazaradian, that there is somebody there for you to hold a hand? There's somebody there to hold your hand through the process.
When did it first call me Peter? I think it's incredibly important. And you know, a quick note that probably needs to be said here. As long as we're dealing with grief and loss, the loss of a child is the most profound loss we can experience. Worse than mom and dad, worse than a husband or wife, worse than sisters and brothers. It is without a doubt the most profound loss we can have. So to have someone share that is incredibly important. Otherwise, we fold up into ourselves, either learn to fake it very well or withdraw from society. So having somebody to, as Harmon says, hold their hand and go through the process. Unfortunately, this is also an incredibly an intense private affair. So you're never sure. In therapy all the time, I hear people say, well, you know, kind of nobody knows my problem. My problem is so unique. But as Armin, you're finding out, there's a lot of folks who have lost children, and they all feel very alone and lost about it. And when you can sort of make that circle and realize, you too, you're going through this too, I can't believe it. It's a very individual process until you touch somebody else. And
exactly.
Don't you find that way?
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's something to be said for it is awkward. It's uncomfortable. But the importance of showing up. And that doesn't mean you have to have answers. I think people feel like they have to fix the problem. You know, I think my grief will last the rest of my life, and I'm learning how to navigate life with this crack running down the middle of me. But when my friends show up, they don't have to give me answers. There are no answers. They just need to be present and visible. And sometimes that means we have coffee together. Sometimes they just come and sit with me. And sometimes we share memories. There are lots of different ways to show up and be there for somebody who's grieving. You don't have to have an answer.
Did you find that in the beginning, right after the loss, that some people stayed away just because they didn't know what to say?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they don't know what to say. They're afraid of offending you, of making you even more sad. And then there's also like the statute of limitations. I didn't go to the funeral. I haven't seen her for a month, and now it's too late. And I guess I would have to say it's never too late. It's never, you know, even dropping a note in the mail, although I like the personal eye contact myself. but I mean, there's lots of ways to share your support and extend yourself to somebody who's grieving.
When did you and Nancy decide to chronicle your journey, decide that we're going to write this down and we're going to make it into a book?
You know, the morning we met over coffee, we were both writers, and we made a pact that morning. We made a decision on the spot. Let's do this. And we hoped that it might save our lives. But we also knew that writing was our own personal therapy anyway. And let's do this because the bookshelves really had very little. Joan Didion wrote Year of Magical Thinking. It was a book about the loss of her husband. C.S. Lewis wrote about his wife in A Grief Observed, a beautiful book. But again, as Peter so beautifully stated, and I think it's so true, losing a child trumps everything. It's the deepest loss anybody can experience. And there was very little on the bookshelves about that. And so we decided we wanted to lift that veil. We wanted to tell the truth. It's not something you get over with in 6 months. And we wanted to create a language for loss.
When you talk about the fact that not much had been written about this subject, for yourself, was there enough for you, or do you think there's enough there for people who are experiencing this kind of grief as far as either help in the community or someplace to read, someplace to even share their thoughts? Because I think, as you mentioned, and I have shared, you know, with you, as Peter said, most of us don't even want to go to that place of thinking about the loss of your child. To think about that kind of pain and how do you handle it is just beyond your imagination because of that attachment you have and that love that you have for a child. So, you know, kind of getting back to that question, did you find that there was enough there for you?
You know, in the moment, no, there wasn't. But I had Nancy, and we both showed up every single day. And my husband was very supportive, and so my resources, I felt like I had what I needed during that time we were writing the book. But I'm learning now that there are lots of resources. There are online resources. There are blogs. There are communities. And one of the reasons we wrote the book was to forge a community where it was okay to talk about all the emotional goo that goes with this loss. And we have hundreds of men and women who are writing to us on our website, on our blog. What we want everybody to know is there are safe places where you can go and share those emotions. There are professionals like Peter who you can go and in private talk about what's the turmoil that's going on inside of you. Because really, this grief can be so profound that you feel like a stranger in your own skin. You feel like an alien. You feel like this puzzle that suddenly is missing her corners. And that's foreign. It was very foreign to me. By day, I'm a functioning professional woman who has to stand before crowds and speak. And all of a sudden, I would stand and stare into space and be incapable of finishing a sentence, wondering if I was going insane. So it's very important to reach out. This is not a journey, in my opinion, that a person can travel solo. I think you have to reach out and find someone, a therapist, a support group, an individual, somebody who can hold your hand and help navigate this treacherous terrain of this place we call Griefland.
Peter, you want to add to that when it comes to the resources and what's available and what you should seek out?
It's interesting. You know, there is, just a tag on something we've been talking about here, there is sort of a formula for when you lose a spouse in terms of grief. There's this crazy kind of formula, which is basically 1 month per year. How long do you grieve? And when you lose a spouse, it's about 1 month per year, which can extend to several years, of course, depending on how long you've been married. We have no formula for a child. Mm-hmm. We have no formula for a parent. We expect to lose our grandparents. They're old. We sort of expect to lose mom and dad, as uncomfortable as that is. At least we sort of understand the circle of life. Well, that's going to happen someday. But a child? We have no formula for that, so it can go on forever. As you said, mm-hmm. I'll probably have this crack running through me forever. Yeah, that's the way it's going to be. So it's important to understand what the process is, to have friends, to have resources, to be able to reach out. And there are people who specialize in that. And sometimes you know, to expand this just slightly, sometimes it's not just about grief. It's about other things in life, too, that come up and hit us sideways. And understanding, you know, how that works and some of the pieces that can be involved in that as well. So it's a bigger picture in some ways.
And, you know, the reality is we're living in an era of loss right now. People are losing aging parents. They're losing friends and colleagues. They're losing spouses. They're losing jobs, breasts. So this whole issue of loss, of losing a piece of yourself, I think it's a universal conversation that needs to take place. And I think it's going to be our generation that has to lift that veil and create that language. And so we're hoping with our book that at least that's the catalyst for some of this conversation to take place.
Well, you say, and you have said, especially in your book, you said that co-authoring this book saved your life.
Yes.
Explain that.
Well, you know, for those first 4 years, I felt this huge gap. I felt like something huge was missing. And I wasn't functioning that well. I was getting through my days. And as Nancy and I navigated this terrain together, I started feeling my senses coming back. I started feeling human again. I realize now that every single moment is a precious jewel. I'm honoring the relationships, the things that matter in my life. I'm learning how to create boundaries for my time because I know that I still have this crack and that there are some days are better than others. And so you get in touch with your own self once again. And I think that's something where all the pace of life is so crazy and insane right now that it's easy to kind of bury the grief or bury our emotional stuff and just live in that manic, frantic lifestyle. And I think one of the lessons grief has taught me is to be comfortable with ambiguity, to learn how to savor the moments of life, to appreciate the good moments, and to know that loss is part of the human condition. I mean, none of us are exempt. And I've made a commitment with the people in my world that I'm gonna help when their losses occur. I'm not going to look away. I'm going to look into their grief, and I'm going to be willing to hold their hand and keep them lifted up. Hopefully,
because what you just described there is so true. A lot of us, when there is someone experiencing something like this, grief, loss. And many different kinds of losses, as you've spelled out, that we do in some way turn away. It's just facing it head on and being there for that person.
Well, I think one of the things we realized early on is if you look at it too closely, then you realize this could happen to me.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, and that's a scary thing to have to deal with, to look at. And so we understand, and, you know, we certainly never passed judgment on anybody who was looking away because that's, I think, a survival strategy that we all use. It's like if I get too close to the action, it might spill on me. I might get my hands dirty. And so, but we're trying to share that, you know, as human beings, we all have to connect with each other, and by doing that, we become more human.
Was there a defining moment when you knew you were sort of on the highway out of grief land?
You know, I would almost have to say a couple of things come to my mind. First of all, you know, my daughter has four beautiful children, and I also have a grandson that Alex had a little boy before he passed away. And to be able to laugh and enjoy moments with them and not be sad. I mean, to absolutely feel joy so much that I feel like my heart's going to jump out of my chest. That's a pretty good sign for me. And in September, when Nancy and I were featured at the Women's Conference, to be able to stand in front of 300 women and share our story and not melt into the podium, I left that day feeling like I'm on the path to my own recovery. It was a very defining moment that day. And to look into the sea of women and realize that, you know what, I'm not really alone. There were lots of women in the room that were also grieving, experiencing loss. And at the end of our session, we all embraced and came together and made a pledge to stay in touch.
You know, Peter, what that says a lot about is the healing power of being able to share this with people. When you spoke at the women's conference, you know, you had had that time to be with Nancy. You all had had that time to really write down and experience the way you felt. So it says a lot for really giving yourself that time that you need to really grieve and then share it with other people.
Time and whatever length of time it takes, there is no, again, formula for this. It's going to take forever. And the people in your life, you mentioned, you know, having a supportive husband and family. And I think you're right when you mentioned that a lot of people sort of get uncomfortable. They want you back because it makes them uncomfortable. It's not about your grief. They probably honor that and hope that you're better and wish you well, but it makes them uncomfortable to be around it. In fact, we've probably all had the experience where, pardon me, somebody, we're deep in thought and somebody says to us, smile.
And, oh,
God. Yeah. And we just want to, you know, and we give that wan little smile because we want to make them feel better. And the other half of us wants to just hit them in the head with a ball peen hammer because it makes us crazy. Yeah. Well, we find out they're not saying smile to us because they want us to feel better. They're saying smile so they can feel better. If we would get that expression off our face that's confusing, uncomfortable, and smile, they'd feel better.
Yeah.
So people sometimes have that, come on, get back in the ball game because I'm anxious and I'm uncomfortable. It's a manipulative device, a little bit defensive, but to get past that and to be able to connect to people and understand that they are uncomfortable, they don't know what to say, they are stretching and struggling to figure out how to make us feel better, and really themselves too. And Juanita, that's the key. They feel uncomfortable. So what Arma is doing by reaching out, by connecting, by embracing people, not just talking about what she's going through, but what we all go through. You're
yes.
right. Losses take the form of people, dreams, hopes, body parts, everything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, the message I think we're trying to send is there's no right or wrong way to grief. And basically any way you get through it is heroic. Trying to give people permission to grieve in their own unique style and way. And I think it does take a lifetime. And you don't want to forget that lost loved one. You don't want it to be all better. And that's okay, too. So it's a very interesting journey, but one ultimately I think that we're traveling and we are getting better.
You know, we have a clip, I think, of I know for you, maybe Nancy as well, that I'd like to play now. I think it's part of your journey, you reading. So let's hear that.
We lived in three houses during Alex's brief lifetime. There was the house where he was conceived, another where he was born, and the third where he spent a majority of his teenaged years negotiating with monsters he insisted were hiding underneath his bed. Although I never actually saw them, I could sometimes hear whispers late at night. By the look in his eyes, they were a constant presence hovering around him. Without any warning, he would run like a track star down our two flights of stairs and then stand perfectly still in the middle of the living room with his lanky arms tightly wrapped around himself, his appearance cold and stiff, as if he had just escaped a blizzard or avalanche. His body language, those arms encircling his torso, hinted that my son was holding on for dear life.
Now, you have done a number of readings from your book. What is that like for you when you sit there and you read your own words?
You know, I just finished recording the audiobook. We thought others might be reading it, and they were insistent, since it's memoir, that we read it ourselves. And it's difficult, it's challenging, but there's growing peace in my heart right now. And I think because I know by sharing this story, it's going to help others. And so, again, the memories, there's always a flood of memories after I do a reading. I keep meticulous notes, so usually after I read a chapter or a segment, I think of another memory and I make another note. And that 1,500-page list of emails continues to grow. And it's a way of keeping Alex in the present tense. And it's okay. I'm enjoying doing that.
Well, for our listeners out there, this story, Armin's story, is archived on the Valley Writers Read page at kvpr.org. And before we wrap up here, just want to know, where are you today? There's a lot going on with your life, a lot coming out of this book. Tell us about where you are today and how has life changed for you?
You know, I have to say life is very, it's beautiful right now for me. We recently had an anonymous donor who donated books to the families in Connecticut who experienced just this horrific tragedy in early December. We've recorded the audio book. We're working on a second book to share the survival stories of other women, so many people that we've met along this path. And I am looking forward to the new year. I think we're invited to several conferences. We have lots of speaking engagements. And life is good. Juanita, thanks for asking.
Well, we're all so proud of you.
Thank you.
So happy to hear about this. And the fact that you and Nancy took this big step to dare to go where so many people just really did not want to go, and the fact that you know now that you're helping so many people.
Well, and I so appreciate this community. Our community has wrapped its arms around us so tightly, and that's been a huge part of our recovery.
Well, we are going to continue to follow you on your journey.
Thank you.
And it was just great to have you here this morning.
Thank you.
And you too, Peter.
Thank you, Juanita.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Trying to find your way back from homelessness is also a tough journey. Many of those on the street are dealing with other problems, drug abuse, joblessness, abusive home life, a criminal past. No doubt it will take a lot to help them rebuild their lives. But Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen's First Step Home program, along with a commitment from the Fresno Housing Authority, is working to do that. In November, the Renaissance at Santa Clara was open. It is a 70-unit apartment building located right across the street from the Pavarello House, and where we also see encampments set up by street people. Here to talk to us about how the Housing Authority and other support services can help some permanently get off the street is Angie Nguyen, Assisted Housing Manager at the Housing Authority for the City of County of Fresno, and also Gloria. I think she's one of your clients, one of the people you are assisting.
Correct.
Okay. Let's start with when the apartment complex at Santa Clara, it is the third Renaissance project. Describe the other two and how they are designed and the whole plan to work to help the homeless.
Okay. Well, each one is actually situated in a location that has been either rehabilitated by construction or was built as a new construction. So the Trinity was previously a convent and was rehabbed into permanent housing. It hadn't been used for many years. The other one, which is Altamonte, which is on Blackstone, was formerly known as the Apollo, which was a rehab center that the County of Fresno used. And the Renaissance at Santa Clara is situated just south of the old Kerrug building. And on Santa Clara and the Ventura area. So that was actually new construction. And the way that the all properties are designed is to provide a living space, which is a single room occupancy unit for every individual, and services are provided on site. The idea is to be able to provide services to address immediate needs, to be accessible daily, and to also be able to immediately address any crises that occur.
How important is it that services are offered as a part of this whole effort to help someone?
The services is the key to being able to successfully transition from street to home. It's a transition for anybody who makes such a huge change in their life and to be able to turn things around. And as it is in the name of all of our properties, a renaissance, it's a renaissance of their life. And so the services are important because we all need some type of guidance and structure and to have someone that will be a better influence on our decision making. And so that is what we hope that service providers can do. They link them to the resources that then will be able to slowly link them back into the community and reintegrate them into daily living.
What did it take to get to this point? Because we, as you know, have been dealing with the problem of homelessness for a long time in Fresno. But what did it take to get to this point, to have people understand that it is you need a comprehensive approach when it comes to trying to help people rebuild, in a way, and that's what it is, rebuild their lives?
Right.
Because it took a while for this community to embrace all of that.
And I think the community is still in the process of embracing that. You know, we have tried many different approaches, and it's been by trial and error. When some things don't work, then we find a way to tweak it and have it work. The Housing Authority is using the Housing First approach now, which does come with some controversy. But we believe that we house the individual first, and then we address all of their issues or any of their needs once they're housed. But because that over years, it has taken us so long to learn that it takes longer to address those issues while they're so unstable on the streets.
Right. I mean, and so like you said, the premise being housing first, isn't it? That first you've got to get them off the street. You've got to get a roof over their head before they can even start that transition.
Correct. And because a lot of times it's getting them into housing that's a process within itself, because we have to gain their trust and have them understand that we're real and that we're really in this with them for the long run, and that we're sincere in our hopes for them to be able to make it on their own or to be able to turn their life around. And so it's a matter of them believing in us and trusting us. And then we then can link them to those services, because we're not trying to set them up for something that they don't want to do.
Gloria, yes. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm born and raised in Idaho, and I came to California in 82. I became homeless in Oakland. I got into drugs. I did drugs and homeless for about 6 years. And when I came to Fresno in 2007, I was homeless.
What brought you to Fresno in 2007?
Well, me and my ex-boyfriend, we came, and he left me here. So I lived on the streets at the Poverello in a tent for 4 years. And thanks to First Step, now I'm into housing.
What was it you said when you came in 2007?
Yes.
And you were on the street? What made it difficult for you to get off the street?
Mainly, you know, just it was myself. And, you know, I went into Naomi's house at the Poverello. The Poverello helped me, but it was difficult because I was caught up in the streets. You know, I didn't really have that edge, you know, anybody helping me to get off the streets.
When you say you were caught up in the streets, because I think that's what a lot of people, I'm trying to make them understand that, because a lot of the people don't understand that,
right,
that cycle. And they think, oh, if you want to get off the street, you just can't.
Right.
But it's not that easy. So when you say you were caught up in the cycle, what?
Well, it's like, you know, you become homeless for so long, you don't have family around you. and you don't have people encouraging you to get off the streets, so you just spend your money, you know, how you can. And it's really difficult unless you really push yourself to help yourself to get off the streets.
Angie, what, and both of you, what does it take? You know, that first step, what has to happen to start that process of transitioning? And I say transition because I would assume it just doesn't happen that quickly. Transitioning off the streets.
You know, everybody is different. Every individual is different. The length of time that they've been on the streets will also play a role in how challenging or how easily that person can make that transition. But I, as I mentioned earlier, I think a lot of it is that trust factor, mm-hmm. that they have to the two individuals working, the service provider and the formerly homeless person, have to agree, and they both have to be on the same plan. And I think then we spend a lot of time in that initial phase just getting them to believe in themselves again. You know, they've been beat down a lot, either by those who didn't believe in them, sometimes physically beat down on the streets. And so that does a lot to a person's morale. So we spend a lot of time in those initial months just rebuilding that morale and then connecting them to some of the mainstream services. You know, so it's so important to be able to have that person trust you. And oftentimes it's just, we just keep trying again and again and again. And there's been many times when we've housed a person numerous times, you know, because then they just keep going back out to the streets because they get caught up, as Gloria was saying. But when they're ready to come back, we take them back. Because if they're not willing to give up, we're not going to give up on them. And I think that over time creates that trust that we need.
You know, Gloria, like mm-hmm. she said, what was it for you that you finally decided, okay, when somebody reached out to you, you were going to take their hand?
Well, when I first signed up for First Step Homes, I didn't go through with the first voucher because my boyfriend at that time, he wasn't really interested in getting off the street, so I let it go. And this time when they came out the second time, I said, it's time for me to change because I'm tired. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you get 55 years old, you're tired. I've lived off the streets.
How long had you been on the streets?
Altogether about 10 years, mm-hmm. from Oakland to Sacramento to Fresno back to Sacramento. So it's been about 10 years since I've been homeless.
How did you survive?
Day by day and by God, you know, just praying a lot.
So when you said that moment when you decided, okay, I'm going to be serious mm-hmm. about this, where did you start?
First, myself. I had to think about my kids, me, and, you know, when First Step Home has come, that was my chance.
And for some people it is. They just need that chance, that opportunity, right?
Right. And they need that opportunity for, you know, and like I said, sometimes we give them one opportunity, sometimes it's more than once. But it's when they're ready. Not when we think that they're ready. And so it's, they do have to make a decision. Gloria made that decision for herself. She said enough is enough. And she saw the sincerity in the staff of the Fresno Housing Authority that, you know, we were really willing and ready to help her. And when she bypassed us the first time, that's okay. We didn't put her at the bottom of the list the second time around. And I think the other key, though, has been that we have been physically out on the streets doing the street mm-hmm. outreach. We don't sit behind our desks waiting for them to come to us. You know, our team has been very active in the streets, either by doing the surveys through our involvement in the 100,000 Homes campaign, which we locally call Project P4. And we survey, we keep a vulnerability index registry, and we continuously check in on the people that are on the streets to see, you know, are you ready? Mm-hmm. and because we really do want to get to those that are very vulnerable. And, you know, Gloria said, you know, once you're 55 and other ailments start to come on, then it's time.
What are some of the other resources that Gloria need?
Well, Gloria has, you know, she is on SSI, right?
Correct.
And so a lot of that is getting her connected to some of those benefits that she would have been had access to when she was homeless. And so there were things that she would have had that she had access to, but she couldn't get to it because she was so unstable. So once she was housed, she was able to file all the proper applications to get that in place. So that has brought in some income that has helped her be able to sustain with the subsidized housing that we're able to provide. Then and with her income, then she's able to not rely too much on too many other resources.
What is required of that apartment tenant? What must they do to help themselves and to be able to access the services?
The services that are provided on site are simply there for their taking. We don't require them to participate. However, we do, because we're on site, we're able to check in on them daily. They are, however, if they have income, they're required to pay rent, and the rent is proportionate to their income. If they don't have income, which is also not a requirement, then that's when the case manager works with them on securing income. And once they do, then they're able to contribute. But the services, what we find is that we provide them, make them to where they don't necessarily feel so clinical. They're engaging. And so eventually they start to come around and see that, well, hey, it's really not that bad. And that the case manager is really here to help me and to help me navigate this very complicated and convoluted system. And when we try to force something on someone, then that's when they start to become very standoffish and are reluctant to participate. So we just take a different approach that we say, this is what's available, this is what we suggest, and this is what we can do for you, but it's ultimately up to you.
Right. So that's what I'm trying to get at, that once they get into housing and you make them aware of the services, what you're saying is then they really have to do some work on their own.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, you do, because like she said, your income, you got to report your income. Like she said, I'm on SSI, so housing does provide for you. It's out there if you want the help. And, you know, like they said, anything you need, just call them, and they're there for you. So.
And for Gloria, where are you now in the process, you think, for yourself?
I'm more self-sufficient. I'm going back to college.
Great.
I'm going to Heald College now. And it's really helped me to sustain myself. No more low self-esteem, relying on other people.
And when she's saying that, isn't that point that where you want them to get? That for her, now what you've done, you've reached out to a person, and this person, by having a home and learning to be more responsible, then going back to school so that they, I would assume, can get a skill and trade to work, then you have a person who becomes a productive member of society. So it all kind of circles back and helps the community.
Correct. And Gloria is well on her way of doing that, both to giving back to her community, you know, giving back to her family. She's been reunited with her family as well. So all of that, it's everything that makes us whole. And so Gloria is well on her way of doing that.
Do you think the public fully understands homelessness? You know, how people get there and how hard it is for them to get them on the road to recovery.
I think that there still needs to be a lot of awareness, a lot of education. Even those of us who work directly mm-hmm. with them and who are in the trenches day to day, we haven't walked their shoes. And so even we just kind of have a glimpse of what it takes. And we just know one side of the challenge. You know, it's, I think there's certainly a lot more to learn.
You know, because what I think the public, what they do is they You know, they'll see people who are living in the encampments, or they'll see somebody on the street, you know, panhandling. But it's so much more than that for that person. I mean, you have to admit that, you know, we're living in a tough time. We've gone through a very tough recession. Many jobs are gone. People have kind of run out of their benefits. It wouldn't take much for, you know, a person to end up there.
Right. You know, and homelessness doesn't discriminate. And, you know, we have our website inquiries that we receive daily. And I can tell you that there's the person who stands on the street corner panhandling, and there's the person that's hiding in the library sending an email to the Fresno Housing Authority because they don't want anybody to know that they're homeless. And so that's their way of secretly asking for help. And so homelessness has many different faces.
And in a way, it's that second person you describe who can end up homeless because they don't know how to reach out for resources, or they are embarrassed to reach out for resources, or may wait until, you know, it's almost too late, until they find themselves really down before they do that. So there are many faces, especially in the Fresno community, where we have a tough economic climate, to really work through this whole process.
Yeah. You know, I think there's also those that don't consider themselves homeless. Mm. You know, perhaps they're doubled up or crashing on someone's couch and couch surfing. And so those are individuals who are just one step away from actually being housed and, you know, for being homeless, because they will probably soon, you know, outstay their welcome. And so I think that there's the person who pretends that they, you know, are just hanging out at the shopping mall, or, you know, just go the youth that goes to school, and it takes a while before someone notices that, you know, they're sleeping in a single motel room, you know, with a family of eight, with very limited resources. So there's a lot of people that are just that one step away from being homeless, and then there are those that are sleeping in places that we would never think about.
Well, we have started the journey, like you said, here in Fresno. We've tried many times, but as long as there are people who aren't giving up and continue to work with this process, then there's hope out there. And Gloria, we wish you the best. Continue on your journey, and having those people to support you. Thank you both for coming in and sharing with us the road to recovery and finding a home.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. There is an ongoing effort to revive, renew downtown Fresno. City planners are considering putting together a public market. Here to talk to us about this is Craig Sharden, Business Development Director at the City of Fresno and Project Manager for the creation of the Fresno Public Market. Craig, also longtime supporter of Downtown Fresno, formerly Director of Downtown and Community Revitalization for the City of Fresno. Thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Tell me about the public market, and what will it be, and why are you looking at Downtown Fresno?
Well, public markets really, I mean, there are many older ones in our country, but many more have sprung up in cities around the United States and around the world. If you look at Spain and Berlin, very famous markets. But in the United States, they've really been a great feature. They house food products that kind of represent their regions. So butcher shops and fresh cut flowers and greengrocers and wines and pies and bakeries and everything you can imagine. So if people have been to Pike Place in Seattle, that's probably the most famous in the United States. And nearby, a different kind of a version that shows how they reflect their region is the Ferry Building in San Francisco, which opened a few years ago.
And for us, why are we looking at downtown Fresno? What makes that a good spot?
You know, in most cities, the public market is downtown, and it's really been a great aid to revitalization. It becomes a place for restaurants and microbreweries and other fun food-related businesses to kind of surround themselves around people that are going to the market to buy their cheeses and sausages and all the other great products that are made
here
locally.
You're making me hungry.
I know, me too. Let's keep talking about it.
What will make this market unique when you think about it? You know, there's so much here to offer. I mean, just the region with the farmers and...
Yeah, well, I'd encourage people, I mean, go look at like the Milwaukee public market that just opened as an example. When you have a chance and you're surfing around the internet, and compare what we grow compared to what they grow in these other cities, Cincinnati or Cleveland, which has a fantastic 100-year-old market. They can't compare to the diversity of crops that we have here. You know, many Midwestern states only grow, you know, crops in the teens, you know, in terms of their diversity, while we have 300 to 400 different crops that we grow here, plus year-round. And we have not only agriculture, but this incredible food industry that we've showcased with the Fresno Food Expo.
That's great.
All of these people making great products with our agriculture and our ethnic diversity on top of it. So you can imagine a place where you can get the best Volga German beer ox or the best Armenian Lamajun.
There he goes again.
Or the best Hmong Pho. And you can really enjoy you know, all of our food and ethnicity and heritage and all of those good stuff.
So what kind of response are you getting? What are you hearing from the community? And what is it going to take to make this work?
Well, I keep hearing people saying, well, duh, which, you know, is sort of encouraging because it means you're on the right track. But everyone says, why hasn't this happened before?
Yeah. Why hasn't it happened before?
I mean, why is it happening in Milwaukee before it happens here? We should be leading on this and not following. And I agree. So mostly, you know, it just seems like a no-brainer to people when you talk about it. It's building on all of our strengths. It's what we're great at. It's what we're known for. So let's put all of these great food companies in one room, and we get to enjoy it. And when people come and visit us, they get to enjoy it too.
Realistic, what are we looking at as far as a timeline for a project like this?
Well, you know, we're really just getting started. You know, we're in the educational phase. We have a group of food-related businesses that have formed an advisory group, and they're really leading this. So it's a very private sector-led effort. And, you know, it's a big project. I wouldn't be surprised if it took us 3 years or so to get this going.
Well, and also to do it right.
Exactly. We want to make sure that this is a big step forward. But, you know, the Fresno Food Expo was kind of one of those first steps to pull the industry together, you know, to get the community excited about and proud of all of the companies that we have here. And that really has encouraged us and the food industry to say, let's take this to the next step.
Well, let's do it.
I know. Okay. We'll have a place to meet for lunch next time.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Craig Sharton, Business Development Director, City of Fresno, and Project Manager for the creation of the Fresno Public Market. We want to see it happen. Thanks so much for coming
in. Like us on Facebook, Fresno Public Market.
Okay, go there, folks. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.